Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week's episode was recorded live at the most recent MK3D show, the monthly show that I do at the BFI South Bank. Our stellar lineup of guests includes Kerry Fox talking about Little Joe and the film that changed her life, James Norton, star of Mr. Jones and The Trial of Christine Keeler, picking a very guilty pleasure, and JP Valkapar, director of the extraordinary Dogs Don't Wear Pants. Oh, and in honour of the release of Little Joe, I also do my rundown of the top 10 plants in movies. Sit back and enjoy MK3D live from the BFI South Bank.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I've been up since 3 o'clock this morning. No, but the thing is, I wasn't up to the 3 because of the Oscars, although I was up since the 3, since you ask, thanks. My son has been away touring places that are very near to the coronavirus but not quite, and he came back he flew into Gatwick at 6 o'clock in the morning, and so Linda and I had to leave the house at 3 o'clock to get to Gatwick. So we were driving whilst the Oscars were happening and on the radio, but so I feel like I've been up through the Oscars, although I haven't. So the show may have a slightly drunken quality to it. I just want to assure you all that I'm completely sober, if a little bit tired. This is the 49th show, which means that the next show is the 50th show. I know that's stating the obvious. And we've got an absolute bonanza for the 50th. It's going to be fantastic. And we've got kind of guests from the 50 shows that we've done before. So very much looking forward to that. There is going to be a musical element. It's just that some of the guests involved don't know about it yet. But there we go. So packed show for you tonight. Let's start, as we mean to continue. We've sort of been doing Ask the Audience at the beginning of the show, sometimes in the middle of the show. I think we'll do it at the beginning just because I'm kind of coherent now. I have no idea what I'm going to be like in about an hour. If anybody has anything they'd like to raise, stick your hand up. I will try my best to make sense of it. Yes, sir. And make it a softball, okay, because I've been up a really long time.
Me too.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, I am going to require a bit of casting one's mind back to a review you did in December 2009.
Okay. You've lost me already, but carry on.
Okay. In your review of...
Hang on. Hey, firstly, did you make a film and was I rude about it?
No.
Okay, fine, because carry on, that's good.
In your review of Avatar, you commented that James Cameron had been, at one time, I quote you, a proper science fiction director.
Yes.
So what I'm wondering is, what does a proper science fiction director mean in your terms?
That's a very good question. What I meant by that was that I've always thought that the very best science fiction is kind of slightly B-movie-ish. I've always felt very suspicious of really, really big-budget science fiction movies. And, like, so my favourite science fiction film of all time is Silent Running, which was made for thrumpence. You know, it was a very, very low-budget film. It was all done with front projection, and I love it. I like Dark Star. I like films that, you know, that actually feel like they're based around an idea. My problem with Avatar, and actually I think Terminator is brilliant, I think Aliens is brilliant. My problem with Avatar was it did look to me like a format searching for a story. Because the story is, oh, we are the Na'vi. Oh, we like to sing and dance in the moonlight. We are probably metaphorical American imperialism, or maybe European colonialism, it doesn't matter. Anyway, but, you know, it was a little bit like that. And then it was like, oh, 3D. It's like 2D, but more. And so that was what I meant. And I know that since then, you know, James Cameron has dedicated himself to making the next two Avatar movies. And, you know, the 3D thing is kind of, you know, it's run its course. We still have 3D movies, but I think everybody's basically agreed that it was a waste of everybody's time. And with certain exceptions, possibly Gravity or something, or, you know, Flesh for Frankenstein, I think, is genuinely improved in 3D when Udo Kier pulls the offal out of the man's, you know, holds it up towards the camera. That's a real joy. But I think that's what I meant. Bear in mind, you're asking me a question about something I said 11 years ago, but I think I'm standing up for it very well. So I think that deserves a round of applause.
Thank you.
Right, let's take another one. Yes, there.
Hi. Sticking with the Oscars.
Yes.
What do women have to do to finally get acknowledged?
You know, it's... I was talking to Jack Howard, who I do... You know, we did the Kermit on Film podcast, that this turns up as a podcast. And the first time Jack watched the Oscars, because he's a child, was in 2010, which is the year that Catherine Bigelow became the first and indeed only woman to win the Oscar for Best Director and Best Picture. And I remember then everyone going, hooray! And then all this time later, everyone going, eh? And yes, the industry itself has to change. The fact that in this particular year, you had this kind of male director's category, when there were so many great movies directed by women, it is particularly troublesome. And I think in the end, it's those award ceremonies reflect the industry itself, but it is depressing how slow it is. And it's also quite boring after a while, because you kind of think, you know, I was looking at Queen and Slim, and I think, you know, Melina Matsoukas did such a brilliant job on that film. And there were just so many great chances for nominations. And so I think what they have to carry on doing is carry on making brilliant films, and finally, slowly, years, decades later, the industry will catch up. But I do think it's happening, really. I mean, my partner, Linda Reese Williams, did this thing, you know, the Calling the Shots report about the statistics for women in the British film industry. And they're shocking. I mean, really, really shocking. If they had in a particular key job anyone above 7-8%, that was considered to be triumphant, you know. And so it is changing, but it's really, really changing slowly. And the only answer is carry on, you know, and we will all catch up at some point, but it's not going to happen in the near future. We will come back to the subject of the Oscars, I'm sure. Since we last spoke, Kirk Douglas died. We wanted to show a clip. This is kind of interesting. We wanted to show a clip in which actually Kirk Douglas doesn't talk, but it's one of the most iconic clips in cinema. And the interesting thing about this, which relates back to 2001, one of the things about 2001 is it's a film in which the most sympathetic character is a homicidal computer who's trying to kill everybody. Apparently, Stanley Kubrick didn't want this scene in Spartacus because he thought it was silly.
Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus. I'm Spartacus!
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 I'm Spartacus.
I just love the idea. I mean, I don't know whether it's true, because, I mean, yeah, there's so much, you know, about... I just love the idea of him going, no, that scene's not going to work. And I interviewed Paul Thomas Anderson a while ago. I may have said this before. I interviewed Paul Thomas Anderson about his career, and we started talking about Magnolia. And I said, you know, the scene I love in Magnolia is the scene when everyone sings Wise Up, the Amy Mann song, which, of course, famously was not written for Magnolia. It was written for Jerry Maguire. And then the director of Jerry Maguire didn't like it and left it off, put it on the soundtrack album, and Paul Thomas Anderson loved it and then built the whole film around it. And I interviewed him not so long ago and I said, I love that scene. He said, yeah, if I remade that film, that's the scene that I'd cut out. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm sick of people telling me how much they like it. So anyway, a few months ago, you may remember I went to Strasbourg to the International Fantasy Film Festival and had a really good time, saw a bunch of really, really great movies. And it just happens that a couple of them are coinciding on the show tonight. I want to start by showing you the trailer for a film which had a really big impact. When I got there, it was the first film I saw, and I saw it in a packed auditorium. And it's one of those films that really, really caught the audience off guard. People weren't sure, you know, what kind of film it's going to be because of the title. And it had a really powerful impact. And afterwards, we all went to the bar and we talked about it for a couple of hours. And I think it's a really terrific piece of work. Here is the trailer for Dogs Don't Wear Pants.
Excuse me, kiva tehdä jotain ihan muuta. Jotain tavallisia juttuja. Eikö sustakin?
Kulti, en mä pidä tavallisista jutuista. Tuhma koira.
Please welcome to the show JP Valkapar, the director of Dogs Don't Wear Pants.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, I think the trailer's terrific, and I think it's lovely to see a trailer in which you hear people go...
Yeah.
How would you describe Dogs Don't Wear Pants? Because I have to say that from my point of view, I didn't know anything about it beforehand, before the title. And I really like the film. I think it's really powerful. But how would you describe it?
Well, I described it as a romantic comedy to my main actress. And I think she's slowly starting to kind of get a hint at what I meant. But
I was told that you have a very dry sense of humour. Do you think that's true?
I don't know.
So... how much... describe for us the fundamentals of the story, giving away only as much as you would want somebody to know in advance.
Well, its main character is a heart surgeon, Juha, and Juha's wife dies in the beginning, drowning, and while Juha tries to save his wife, he almost himself drowns, but in this state of asphyxiation, starts seeing visions of his wife becoming alive. So Juha is saved, but goes into this deep state of grief, and 10 years pass, and he and his daughter are living sort of inside his grief bubble. Then he stumbles into a dominatrix dungeon and gets strangled, and the visions start to come back, and he starts to see his wife again after all the years.
So the central thing about it is, and I think this is really important, is that there is at the heart of it this kind of this grief, this tragedy, this trauma, and through S&M, he achieves an ecstatic state in which he transcends life, and he is reunited with this lost love. That's the core of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
How hard was that as an idea to write about? Because obviously, immediately you start talking about, you know, S&M and things. People have certain preconceptions about what it means.
Yeah, it's based on another writer's original idea, and it was a script that had been worked for years but hadn't had a successful outcome. So the producer of the film introduced me, and it sort of started. It triggered immediately images in my head when he told the core idea of it. But it was very hard to get the kind of right balance for the story. It was maybe a year or so. It was very dark, firstly, and then I felt that it wasn't working, and I went version and versions, but I started writing these kind of dad jokes to one of the characters just for my own amusement.
Yeah.
Suddenly the humor started to resonate in it, and then I started adding it bit by bit, and then it became a romantic comedy.
It is a really terrific balancing act between the humour and the tragedy. I mean, the film is really entertaining, but it's also kind of profoundly disturbing, but also quite ecstatic. And did you go back and look at other films as references? Did you look at like Barbet Schroeder's Maitresse or Taxi on Chloe or anything like that?
I had seen Barbet Schroeder's Maitresse, but I wanted to avoid other movies. When approaching this subject,
sure.
I wanted to try to get an sort of how would I say sort of authentic feel to the film about the SM or BDSM, that meant that I had to go straight to the source. So I had real dominatrix, Wild Ira, her name. She had been in the profession for 20 years. She became the consultant for the film. And yeah, I mean, it was a very sort of eye-opening experience. Mm-hmm. We went with the actors to the real sessions
One of the things that's very important about BDSM is it is all to do with consent. Mm. It is all to do with, and I think that is something that often gets overlooked from the outside, is that actually it's an area in which very clearly delineated lines of engagement exist, and yes, consent is the key to it.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of the most important sort of thing that I got out of the research was this kind of the central idea of trust. Mm-hmm. that's there and how sort of how it's everywhere, the trust. I mean, starting from the that your identity is kept secret, then you open up all your sexual fantasies to a person, and then, I mean, even your life can be trusted to another person. And I found that there was something sort of profoundly moving in a way about these power dynamics, that they there was something so primitive that it touched me, something that reminded me the association that I got was the relationship between a newborn and the adult, the parent. Yeah. And how the weak one also has power over the strong one, but is of course dependent on the strong one to take care of. And that was something that I felt that that sort of clicked something in my head in case of this story, which is in a way about the rebirth.
So I saw it at Strasbourg, and I said it was a very full audience, and it really played well. When did you first see it with an audience, and how did the audience react?
The first public screening was in Cannes. It played in the director's fortnight, and I think there was laughter, and the end part of the film it sort of turns into quite a comedy. Even it has even a kind of farcical quality to it, but also there were this kind of very strong Cannes reactions there.
What's a Cannes reaction?
it's the Italians slapping the chairs and yelling, "It's a disgrace!"
Excellent.
Yeah, and which is the highest honor.
It is. There is a thing, just for anyone who doesn't know, there is a thing which is called the Cannes applause, which is as people get up, the chairs go boom.
And if you get like a whole lot of them, boom, boom, it's almost like anti-applause. Yeah. And it's fantastic sometimes if you hear like 20 people leaving at the same time. It's really thrilling.
It is. Yeah, that's the best compliment. And it was in the nail scene that was in the trailer.
Oh, yeah.
But I have no idea what the Italians have with the nails. Can anybody tell?
Any Italians in the audience? Well, if so, they're all remaining surprisingly quiet. I've got a real thing about teeth.
Okay.
I mean, the last kind of, you know, there's the last. If Marathon Man you find hard to walk in the park. And when that reaction happened, did you think that's what I wanted? Because if you take a film to Cannes, that's what you want, right?
Yeah. That definitely was. I watched Marathon Man some years ago, and a couple of years ago, or 4 years ago, and I watched the tooth pulling scene there, and I thought that it was censored.
No.
But it wasn't. It was too short.
You think?
Yeah.
You wanted more tooth pulling?
Yeah, then I made that one.
You're a very sick man. You know.
So they say.
No, the first time I watched Marathon Man, I thought I was going to pass out. And when I was in Strasbourg watching that, and your scene does indeed take its time. But it's also funny because it is, you know, there is a lot of kind of near slapstick humour in it amidst all the sort of tooth pulling. Is it difficult to get that balance right? Is it a lot of recutting to get that? Or
I mean, I had excellent actors in the roles. Yeah. I mean, they are, I mean, and not only that, they are sort of excellent dramatic actors. They are also great in comedy. So it was written quite specifically. It was kind of I wanted it to have this kind of symphonic structure that you go up and you have this kind of dynamics there. So it just took time. It was 1.5 days that we shot the whole sequence.
Great. What are you doing now?
I'm writing a crime film about Finnish alcoholics and in Costa del Sol.
Are there a lot of Finnish alcoholics in the Costa del Sol?
Yeah. That's the way the Finns end up in Costa del Sol. Everybody dies of liver cirrhosis. So. But alcoholism and haste, this kind of kidnapping and crime film, it's good because you fuck up even more than usual.
What's your favorite film ever?
I think it's Godfather 2. I think it's
good choice. And what's the worst film ever made?
I'm intuitively thinking Forrest Gump, but there must be something else.
Why do you hate Forrest Gump? You got a ripple of applause. So hang on. So there are other people in the audience who think Forrest Gump's the worst film ever made. I like. What have you got against Forrest Gump? I mean, you know. Go on.
I just hated it. I mean, everything's wrong. I mean, what happens to the wife? The wife is in the feminist. She's a feminist. She's in folk movement, hippies, whatever, Black Panthers, and so on and so on. And she dies of AIDS. And what happens to Forrest Gump, who has sex with the wife? And nothing. He doesn't get the AIDS. It's all wrong. I wish Forrest Gump would have gotten AIDS. Then I would have loved it. Then it would have been one of my favorite, maybe past Godfather 2.
And there, in a nutshell, is... Here's the thing with Forrest Gump, quite seriously. I understand all the political arguments about Forrest Gump, because believe me, when the film came out, you know, people... I kind of like it. I think it's cute.
I was an angry teenager when I saw it.
Yeah. I think...
It could be that now I'm a mellowed, middle-aged man. So
yeah, I think
maybe
it's...
Maybe I like it. Yeah, it's good that he didn't get AIDS.
Yeah. I just don't know where to go with that thought at all. So the film opens here in March, is that right?
Yes, March 20th.
And will you be coming back to do, or is this it? Just come over to do this and then you...
I don't know after this one, if they allow me, but it's the distributor is Looking thumbs up still. But okay, I'm coming back.
And JP, it is, everyone does call you JP. Your full name is?
It's Jukka-Pekka Valkeapää.
JP is much easier.
Yeah.
Say it to me again.
Pardon?
But the
name?
Yes.
Jukka-Pekka Valkeapää.
Let me have a go at it because my accents are really short. Yeah. Jukka-Pekka Valkeapää.
Brilliant. Yeah? Perfect. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Film opens in March. Go and see it. It's really terrific.
Thank you very
much. Thank you,
Blake. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Andrew.
Very pleasure.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, momentarily lost for where we're going next. As you all know, how many of you saw the BAFTAs? If any of you saw them on television, when Bait won Best Newcomer, right, and they announced Mark Jenkin, did you hear a woman go, ah? That was Linda. That was my... Because we were at the BAFTAs and we were kind of quite near the front, and when it won, we were just delighted. So, because the other thing that happened at the BAFTAs was that 1917 won both Best Director and Best Film. So it's a kind of interesting thing that it won at the BAFTAs and Parasite won at the Oscars, which in a way is kind of nice that it breaks down like that. There was just a couple of things that I wanted to mention in relation to 1917. The first one is that my colleague, Mike Hammond, has this book out, The Great War in Hollywood Memory, and just the weekend of the BAFTAs, in fact, the day of the BAFTAs, Neil Brand, who's coming on the show for the 50th show, played a live accompaniment to the big parade, and it was really fantastic. If you get a chance to see that film, because clearly 1917 owes a great debt to that. Mike's book is absolutely fantastic. I mean, I know I'm in a band with him and all the rest of it. I'm not contractually obliged to say this. It is a brilliant book. It also made me start thinking about the film of the Battle of the Somme. As you know, I'm down in Exeter quite a lot, and the Bill Douglas Museum has got the camera that they shot the Battle of the Somme on. And looking at 1917 and thinking back to the film of Battle of the Somme, which of course is fascinating because it is a documentary, but it's also a documentary which employs a certain degree of dramatic license. You'll know famously the scene of them going over the top is staged, and it's kind of like Nanak of the North, that whole kind of interplay between what's completely documentary and what is restaged. Plus, if you saw the Peter Jackson They Shall Not Grow Old, obviously they used and repurposed footage from Battle of the Somme, but it is really terrific. And if you've seen 1917 and like 1917, it's really worth checking out Battle of the Somme. It is available on a number of streaming services. You can watch it on Amazon. I don't think it's on the BFI player, but maybe at some point in the future. But it is worth checking out because you can kind of see a lot of where the inspiration for that comes from, and it is an extraordinary document. Okay, on to our next coming attraction. A few shows ago, we were talking about Little Joe. This was immediately after Strasbourg, because the other film that did really, really well at Strasbourg, where Dogs Don't Wear Pants won the crossover award, was that they played Little Joe, and I absolutely loved Little Joe, and I thought it was terrific. And Emily Beecham came on the show, and we talked at the time about, nearer to the release, about getting another guest on. I'm delighted to say that we have another guest. So here is a clip from Little Joe, which, as you know, I spoke about before. It is a film about a genetically modified flower that may or may not be having a strange effect on the people around it. It's meant to be a flower that makes you happy, but there's a kind of lotus eaters thing going on there. So have a look at this clip and I'll get our next guest up.
Will you please stop blaming little Joe for whatever was wrong with Bello?
Blame little Joe? We're talking about a plant, aren't we? If anyone's to blame, it's you. Haven't you noticed how Chris has changed?
No.
I have the feeling he's infected too.
Infected?
From little Joe's pollen. Chris will defend little Joe at any price.
And why shouldn't he? I will defend little Joe as well, because I am responsible for him.
So you're a good mother. But which of your children will you choose?
Please welcome to the show the fabulous Kerry Fox. I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
It's a great pleasure.
We have talked about Little Joe a bit before. Again, it is hard to describe because it's as much about what's implied as what actually happens. How would you describe what Little Joe is about?
Well, it's about this woman who everyone believes is mad, but who may be the only sane one in the entire film. That's the same answer as for Blanche DuBois, isn't it?
That's very good, yeah. That's a great answer, though. Okay, but it is... Is it a science fiction film, or is it... What is it?
It's a creepy humanist... It's female. It's a very girly film. It's a girl version of creepy horror, and where people are sort of slimy and weird, and nothing's clear. Like, there's no... You don't know which side of the fence you're supposed to fall. You don't know what's real or what's not, who's ill, who's not, if the plant is evil or it's not. So it's ambiguous.
One of the things I loved about it, again, not knowing anything before I went in, was I did spend at least two-thirds of the film thinking the plant isn't doing anything at all. It is all in everybody's mind.
Yes.
And that ambiguity, it's directed by Jessica Hausner, and there is a season of her films happening here at the BFI.
Oh, good.
And I believe... are you coming back here to do a Q&A on the day that it opens?
I've got no idea.
I think you may be. If you're not, we're going to organise it retrospectively. Describe working with her for us.
I love her. I just loved every minute. I mean, she drove me... completely nuts.
In what way?
35 fucking takes of the same thing. Jesus Christ. One of the last ones, like, she never used a Steadicam, she'd always use slow tracks, and it was all very, very... Everything is completely thought out and completely precise. We did 35 fucking takes on, you know, the Steadicam. The first time she'd used Steadicam was on the last day, and it was Ben's last shot. I think I might have had something else a bit later in the day. And then after the 35 takes, she decided she didn't like it. And we do the whole scene. So then they laid the track and we did another 26 of the same. And even Ben Whishaw, who is the most gentle, most gorgeous, most beautiful man, grabbed me by my chest when we finished one of the takes. Why don't they fucking hurry up? She just goes, oh, she's very, very, she's very sweet and she's very lovely. And she says, now, Carrie, I thought it was wonderful, it was all very good. But I just don't want you to have your hands here. I want you to have your hands here. And you go, okay, I can do that another 25 times. And then she says, I know. Some people, I find that some people, when they work with me, they find it very difficult to be spontaneous. Luckily, it's not something I struggle with.
Okay, but that you say it was brilliant, but that sounds nightmarish.
Well, it was nothing like... It was unlike anything I'd ever done, because I've done improvised films, yeah. And, you know, and I've less and less memory because of my age, so I find, you know, retaining my lines quite tricky. But in this case, it was like the precision was... I loved the way she just knew what she wanted, and she made the film she wanted, and that is so rare. That is almost impossible in my experience, and she was such an inspiration to me. She gave me the confidence
well, then I'm going to make my own film after that. You know, I just sort of didn't
as
know
a result,
what
as a result
I wanted,
of working
yeah.
with her.
Yeah, yeah. It was a final kick up the bum that I needed to, you know, to say I can be directorial or sort of dictatorial, whichever one you want, or manipulative, all those lovely terms you want to use with great directors.
People always talk about, this is the third time we've invoked him so far, but people always talk about Kubrick taking scenes again and again and again and again. And it's not considered to be crazy, it's considered to be perfectionism. Do you think there is a part of people looking at a woman director as opposed to a man and saying if a woman director does something 40 times, it's different?
I wouldn't know. I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of prejudices against women directing. I think the hardest thing they face is the condescension from people around who want to, you know, mansplain everything, or this idea that they don't really know the technical and the, you know, they're not all over everything. That I think I see that a lot, and I see the way different women play that. Like, there's no point being confrontational. Say, I know what I'm doing. I know, you know, you have to allow these people, men, to say what they want to say so that then you can go move on. You sort of, you know, but you can't ignore them. And also with other, I'm thinking with other women too, I've got a specific example in mind where a woman who wasn't so sure of what she wanted, but her method was different. Mm-hmm. She's a great filmmaker, she's a great producer as well. Her method was to get everybody to deliver all their ideas, and she'd go, that's good, that's good, that's... And what I realised, we were working with a number of women on that, and high-profile roles in that, but the men wanted her to say, your idea was the best, you're the best one. They, you could see the pick me, you know. And I really observed that was their response they're used to getting.
Yeah.
And so for a woman to then appear to be uncertain or wishy-washy or not be sure what she wanted, it was considered a negative thing. Whereas what that director then had was this massive amount of option in the edit, you know. There are certainly different processes, you know, and I'm not saying they're particularly only women do this or only men do this, and I think a lot of the great male directors have enormous female qualities, who, you know, this sort of digging into human nature, and, you know, but women do face condescension.
There was a question earlier on. No, actually, I'll let that run. There was a question earlier on about what do women filmmakers have to do to get recognition. Do you think things are changing?
Well, the statistics show no. I mean, I feel there's a push for backing, for finance, for support. I think we need more female film critics.
Well, that is absolutely
that's
true.
Significant. I often think about this a lot, about why women find it so hard to drink? direct. to direct. And I think it's to do with youth. I think young boys, I can say that because I have two young boys, when they do something, they just, you know, when they're 19 and they make a film, you know, they don't, let's do it, you know, they don't consider the risks or what might go wrong. I think that women, girls, are very concerned about what may go wrong. They're forward planning, that, you know, and I think that's a real hold up in the creation of film.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
sort of puts the brakes on things. And I don't know whether that's cultural or gender or all, but I see that as a reason why it's women are held back for their own well, and also fear, because I had to, well, for me, working with Jessica, I worked around that time I did Jessica's film, I worked with 7 female filmmakers in a row, bang, 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 and they, you know, phenomenal, like Billy Piper and other, oh, it was amazing activist in Australia called Miranda Tapsell, and, you know, others, and I really had to think, why has it taken me so long to do something I've so much wanted to do, and fear, it's fear of... of being the boss, you know, I am a bossy person, as my friends know. And also, you know, often on set, my nickname is Scary Fox.
Is that right?
And because I don't take any bullshit. It's not that I, you know, I just ask the questions and I don't, someone says, you know, I need to, you know, I push and want things to be really good and hard and tight. And then, so I had to look at me and why is it that it's taken me, and it was because it was confidence. Like, I knew I could do it, and when I finally did it, I was so thrilled and so happy and so assured of myself because of seeing all these seven women, and that evidence, and I realised that I had all of that in me. It's confidence. That's it.
Can I take you back many years back to Shallow Grave, mm-hmm. which I remember seeing, because you'd worked with Danny on Mr. Rose Virgins beforehand. Yeah. And I remember seeing Shallow Grave for the first time, just being really knocked out by it, both because of the simplicity of its premise, but also the complexity of it. It is a film which you can watch over and over again. Do you mind if we show a clip from Shallow Grave? Because I imagine everyone's seen Shallow Grave. If you haven't, get up to speed.
Emergency.
No. Just think about it.
No.
Come on, David.
No.
Juliet.
No, Alex.
It's what?
Unfeasible.
Was that all?
You mean immoral.
I know what I mean.
Look, I'm only asking you both to think about it.
It's a sick idea, Alex. It's sick.
Yeah, but don't tell me you're not tempted. Don't tell me you're not interested. I know you well enough.
Oh, you think so?
Well, go ahead, then. Telephone the police. Go ahead. No one's going to stand in your way. Telephone them. Tell them. Tell them there's a suitcase full of money and you don't want it.
What I love about that scene is actually all the dialogue is happening with eyes and faces. I mean, there is dialogue in it, but that's not what's telling you the story.
And there's all the other stuff, like me lying in the bath. I remember Danny saying, I want you to look like you're lying in a bath of water of money. And the knives behind Chris, you know, that I hadn't ever seen before. I didn't realise.
Did you... Was it a positive experience making that film?
I loved it. It was great. It was really... Because I had this other experience with Danny and we made this TV series, which I really adored making as well. It was tough and adventurous and...
Mr. Rose Virgins.
...never be made now. We talked about wanting to make a film together, and then he posted me a letter asking me to do it, you know, which I got 85 months later in New Zealand, you know. And then we just had a great time, really just, you know... I knew from watching the rushes that it was going to be great. It was just really...
And apparently that flat, it's big. It's bigger than it should be. The whole set design is...
Yeah. So the whole idea was the flat was another character and it was in a studio, but of course it wasn't a studio, it was a shed. And then, you know, all the rookie problems that we had that it was built on, because we had to be underneath for the underneath floor scenes, it was built on, you know, with not much money, on really rickety... you know, wobbling, noisy. So every time we moved, it was like a pain to move the dolly. Sound, nightmare, blah, blah.
I loved the film when it came out, and I got given a Shallow Grave shovel, an engraved Shallow Grave shovel. And I've got very few bits of movie memorabilia, but it's one of the things I'm most proud of because I think it's such a great... I want to show a clip now from Intimacy, which was... It is such an extraordinary piece, you and Mark Rylance. And what's your memories of making Intimacy? Because it was really sort of well received at the time. It was front cover of Sight and Sound, and it was. What do you remember about making it?
I don't remember it being well received in the UK. I remember it being well received in other places, and you know, I think the timing was very difficult. It was released in America 2 weeks after 9/11, so it sort of just died basically, which was incredibly disappointing. I'd been speaking to Patrice Shaw for a long time before he finished the script, and so it was the working on this idea of that he first came to me with not the script, this idea that he wanted to make something that was about a truthful relationship that was expressed through physicality, that, you know, and I felt that's what we made, which was really great. And obviously, you know, working with Mark, who's so, you know, such an extraordinary actor, and Tim Spall as well, yeah. And then Marianne Faithfull, for grief, you know. That was exciting. It was full of memories for me. It was intense, obviously, but I felt very strongly that I wanted to, it was about changing. I was so sick of seeing this bullshit representation of intimacy on screen, and I knew that I wanted to effect change.
Okay, let's have a look.
I thought that perhaps you'd said something at one point that I didn't hear, and that's what you're holding against me.
Listen, I don't understand the first thing about you. How can I hold anything against you?
Did I miss something? What did I miss? Well, then ask me something. Anything you like. Go on,
all right,
now.
I'll ask you something. Why did you tell Andy? Since it wasn't all that important anyway. It wasn't worth it, was it? Well, I fussed for nothing. Still, I don't know. Maybe that's how it works between you two. You tell him each time, and that's it. I mean, you weren't like someone who you asked to drop by, who comes by and fucks and goes and just for the thrill of it. What was I meant to feel?
What was I supposed to be like? Who should I have been to keep everyone satisfied, just to come and see a man and bury myself in his arms because I wanted to? It had been a long time since I wanted someone. And it was with you I wanted to start again. Not supposed to say that, usually, are you?
You've had such an extraordinary body of work and through so many, you know, different moods and films. And we asked you to choose a film that had inspired you, a film that you found inspirational. And your choice surprised me, actually. Not because I don't think it's a brilliant film, but I hadn't expected it. What did you choose?
Drive.
So there's a very specific scene that you chose. We'll talk about that in a minute. Tell me when you first saw Drive and what it was about it that struck you.
Oh, I can't remember the first time I'm not very good at holding on to films. Like I watch them, they don't stick in my mind. They just, it's not where my memory sits, you know. So now I realise I must have watched it like four or five times, and even when I was watching it before this, I still have my fantasy version of the ending, which is entirely different from the actual ending. I sort of think, oh, but that's not what happens. It's sort of like, you know, so it's more the spark of things. I mean, the reason I chose it for this is because I just felt that so many of the images were really, like, useful to me for what I was wanting to make. And I love the structure, the framing and the intensity and the eyes and the cross hatching and the colours, the orange and the blue, and the not saying anything, and the incredible, like, in the scene that I've chosen, this intensity between the two performances, that's just so much is revealed, and the vulnerability, Ryan Gosling's vulnerability in it is just so moving, and it just makes the hairs on my whole being trigger when I see it. I don't know, really.
No, that's great. So let's see the film. I think what's relevant, again, is it's one of those things in which nothing appears to be happening, but everything appears to be happening at the same time. And I think that's it kind of, for me, there was a comparison between that and the Shallow Grave thing, in which it's not what's being said, it's what isn't being said. Anyway, let's have a look.
What do you do?
I drive.
Like a limo drive?
Like for movies.
Oh. You mean all the car chases and stuff?
Yeah.
Isn't that dangerous?
Thank you.
It's only part-time. Mostly I work at a garage.
Where?
Reseda Boulevard.
So it's just like they fall in love.
And then he stamps on somebody's head. do you see echoes of that now, therefore, in your own work, in your own directing?
Oh, yeah. I took great strength from that, from lots of the... my love of the actual cinematography, basically, and the music, the confidence in that. That's a big thing with Jessica's film, actually. That gave me a huge... boost of confidence in my own decision making about music and composition and how to pull all that together, because her in Little Joe, it's so wild, it made me laugh so much.
Well, she uses the Teji Ito stuff, which is completely mad and brilliant, but almost totally contrapuntal, which is which is fantastic. So, look, thank you so much for coming in. So, Little Joe comes out in the not-too-distant future. And what's the next...
Billy Piper's film.
Which is out when?
Don't know. Rare Beasts. She was at Gothenburg. She's going to South by Southwest with it. I don't know what's happening with it, actually.
Okay.
I'd be interested to see the response from that. I think... I don't know. I really love it. When I read the script, it was like something I'd never read before. It's so visceral. And, hopefully... there'll be women criticising it who won't label it hysterical, but rather true.
Kerry, thank you so much. It's been really great having you on the show. And would you come back when whichever of the next films comes out?
Sure, absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kerry Fox.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kerry. Thank you. So we were doing very quickly, off the back of Little Joe, which I may have mentioned is coming out quite soon, we decided to do a top 10 sinister plants in the movies. Now, I'll be honest with you, some of the plants aren't that sinister. But it was, it was like, okay, fine. So, top 10 sinister plants at number 10, The Evil Dead, bad things happen in the woods, plants come to life. BBFC end up getting the film banned for 5 years under the Obscene Publications Act. At number 9, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Now, I know technically people say it's not a plant. Well, they're pods. Pods, cocoons, plant. I think it counts as plants, okay? Thank you very much, because we were stretching ourselves somewhat. At number 8, I don't know how many of you will have seen this, Shrooms. Yeah? Have you seen it? No, it's an interesting film. It's about shrooms. People take a bunch of... shrooms, incidentally, it's young people speak for mushrooms. it's a hallucinogenic... tripping out in cinemas. Actually, it's a really interesting film, which I really liked. Although I did have to go, what's a shroom? Oh, I see a mushroom. At number 7, Guardians of the Galaxy. Because there is actually an entire character that is a plant. And there aren't many of them, although we did find another one. At number 6, WALL-E. The whole of the first act of WALL-E, with the thing with the plant and the thing, which is, it's the MacGuffin in the film, but it is the centre of the film. And also, WALL-E is essentially a remake of a film which is going to turn up slightly higher up in the charts, which is one of my favourite films of all time. At number 5, and this was the most difficult one, Leon. Big plant movie. You've all seen Leon, right? That was Nick's. That was the best of all the suggestions. At number 4, a film which didn't play in UK cinemas, Annihilation. Definitely plants. Barack Obama had it on his list of the favourite films of the year that it came out.
over here it was largely seen on streaming services, although apparently it did play a couple of engagements, I think, at the Prince Charles. Worth seeing on the big screen because it's absolutely brilliant. At number three, Thing from Another World, starring James Arness as a big carrot. This was like, because when they remade it, you know, John Carpenter said, well, now we have all this polymethylcellulose and, you know, these kind of acetates and things in which we can do special effects. I still think James Arness as the big carrot is really impressive. At number two, the film of which Wall-E is clearly a remake, Silent Running, greatest science fiction film ever made, made by Doug Trumbull as a response to having worked for several years on 2001 and deciding that he'd like to make a film that had some people in it that you could actually like. And plus, you know, it is entirely plant-based. However, number one, best slightly scary plant movie of all time, and we have a clip for you, just in case you didn't believe it. Now, you may say again. Wait. Just pretend you didn't all shout that out, and then when it comes up at the end of the show, act surprised. Can we get a non-cine literate audience? Because sometimes it's like, they don't need me. At number one, thank you for bringing it up. Now, I saw Day of the Triffids when I was at school, okay? And it scared the bejesus out of me. And I hadn't seen it since I was at school. And I said to Nick, can you get a, you know, good scary clip? I realised that times have changed, okay? Look at this extraordinary special effects sequence. No expense spent. Day of the Triffids. I'm sorry, but it is absolute genius, isn't it? Okay, moving on to our next. The movie that opened on Friday. Here's a trailer from it. I think it's a really interesting film. I reviewed it on the Radio 5 show on Friday. This is the trailer for Mr. Jones.
Here's the agenda now.
I don't have an agenda, unless you call truth an agenda.
Yes, but who's truth? What you do when the others come forward?
What's being done here will transform mankind.
We can still do something. No. We cannot let Stalin get away with this.
What do you expect me to do exactly?
The Soviet Union is not the workers' paradise that was promised. It is not the great experiment that you read about in the press.
Stalin is not the man who you think he is.
Are you saying there's no hope?
Please welcome to the show, James Norton. How are you doing?
I'm all right, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you so much for coming on the show. So, working with Agnieszka Holland,
yes.
What was that like?
Wow, where do I start? A privilege? Surprised. I'd known a bit about her work, not a much. I mean, I imagine far less than most people in this room. But she did not disappoint. My God, she is a power, and she is getting sharper and more powerful and more opinionated. I had as much fun off set, off camera, as I did on. I mean, it goes without saying, she's a master of her craft. She's a beautiful filmmaker. She seems at the age of 71 to continue to kind of break new boundaries and explore and experiment as if she's at the beginning of her career. The time we had off camera, off set, was just also a joy. We would be holed up in these bizarre towns in North Ukraine, and it was the beast from the east, and we're like rattling the shutters, and we'd be sort of sitting there with a bottle of vodka and a plate of herring, and she would just...
Sounds like my kind of heaven.
It is, yeah. Your Friday night. She would just... She got so impassioned because Brexit had just happened, and it was all kind of, it was just a very hot, I mean, not that any time is not charged right now, but it was a particularly charged time, and she was just an inspiration to listen to, and disagree with and fight and argue with, but a joy. I loved it. I loved her.
Tell us about the story of Mr. Jones. We've seen the trailer, but what's it about?
So it is about a young journalist who was 29 years old. It's a true story, or inspired by true events, I should say, because there are a couple of moments we take artistic license, which have been picked up by the family subsequently, so we should recognise them. But yeah, it's about this young man called Gareth Jones, who previous to the film, he had managed to kind of ingratiate himself onto Hitler's plane, the Richthofen. He was this kind of young, very serious, bespectacled Welsh journalist, spoke lots of languages, incredibly intelligent, having been the foreign advisor to Lloyd George, was then fired and became a kind of self-defined investigative journalist. Having interviewed Hitler on this plane, he then decided that he wanted to interview Stalin. He spoke Russian and knew that something wasn't right. The world was looking at the communist experiment, hoping that it was going to work because the crash of 29 was screwing everyone. And he knew that something wasn't right. So he basically got to Moscow and then went rogue. And whilst all the other journalists were confined to the city, he went and managed to get a train to Ukraine and walked through the villages and discovered the Holodomor, the Russian famine, discovered millions and millions of people were dying because of collectivization and the five-year plan. And because of the propaganda machine coming out of Russia, no one in the world knew about it at all. And he went back to the UK, having been caught, tried to tell everyone, no one believed him because everyone wanted Russia and the communist experiment to work. He basically was the first man at the age of 29 to blow the whistle on the Soviet Union. And it took him a year to get the journalists to believe him. And then the day before his 30th birthday, this is all at the end of the film and it's all on Wikipedia, he went to Mongolia and was kidnapped by a tribe, and they think now that the tribe was hired by the Soviets and they shot him.
His guide was a Soviet agent, is that right? Exactly. Yeah.
So he died the day before his 30th birthday.
How much of that story did you know before the film came along?
Absolutely nothing. And this is the embarrassing thing. I mean, I don't know. I would love to know anyone, apart from through the movie, if anyone knew about Mr. Jones, Gareth Jones, because I did not. And he is such an extraordinary figure. Because he died at the age of 29, I think he really hasn't had the kind of attention and the celebration that he deserves. What's even more embarrassing is that I didn't know much about the Holodomor. I mean, historians estimate between 3 and some say 12 people sort of settle around the kind of 4-5 million people, but that's how many people died. And, you know, we spend all our school years and sort of later on just looking at the Holocaust, and rightly so, but very, very little attention is put on the Holodomor. And, you know, a lot of the international community still don't recognize it as a genocide. Russia deny it happened entirely. You know, that this is one of very, very few films which is about the Holodomor, and I'm very embarrassed to say that I knew very little about it before.
So how did you get the part? What was the quality that you brought that Agnieszka Holland saw that you were right for the role? Other than your weighty historical knowledge of the subject.
Well, I think she wanted... Well, I know that someone dropped out, so that's the first time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which is great.
Yeah, well, more fool them.
More fool them. I can't even remember the name of the guy. So
Ewan McGregor. No, I've got no idea.
No. I think what we discovered quite early on is that she wanted someone... She wanted someone who had that kind of boundless energy. Maybe that sort of Labrador quality that I have. She wanted someone who...
I have never heard anybody describe themselves as having a Labrador quality. I think that's really impressive.
Everyone in my life describes me Labrador, so I mean, I've just taken it on the chin. We needed someone who was very, very serious and earnest, and he basically, you know, paid the ultimate price, lost his life for the pursuit of truth. He is the ultimate investigative journalist as far as the modern world is concerned. But he also had a kind of gentle, slightly gauche quality. You know, some of the more interesting and valuable research, because there's lots of books, you know, there's all the research you can do, and there's always mad research you can do. Often the most valuable stuff is the one letter which you have from his great aunt describing him with his nieces and nephews, and he's sort of crawling around the floor and he's having a lovely time. And he's this kind of big kid. And you know, there's a lot of speculation as to whether he fell in love, and we don't think he really did. So on the one hand, he's this very, very intelligent, very earnest, very sort of principled man. And on the other hand, he's a kid, and he's on a bit of an adventure, and he's an adrenaline junkie. Why she came to me, I don't know. Maybe someone, a weird mixture of those things, I guess.
I think that the thing that I really liked about the film is that I did know the history thing, But actually, the way the film tells its story, you discover it as he does.
Yeah.
And even if you know, it does a really good job of just unfolding as he discovers things. And actually, when you get into the sort of the third act, when he finally finds out what it is that's happening, it is still shocking and horrifying, even if you kind of knew it was coming from the beginning and you've gone through all those decadent scenes in Moscow, which are kind of like, you know, pre-World War II Berlin almost. Yeah. And I think that, and the, you know, the way that the colour palette changes from those warm colours to the terrifying coldness of the Ukraine stuff. I mean, I thought it worked as a really effective thriller as well. Now, that's not the only film that you've been in that people will have seen recently. You were in Little Women, and what was that like?
Oh, I mean, again, to talk about working with some amazing filmmakers, Greta Gerwig.
Who should have been nominated for a Best Director Oscar.
She really should. I've been listening to this conversation this evening about, you know, why it is that women have not been recognised. It's an interesting question, which has actually been thrown my way recently, because having worked with some incredible female filmmakers like Agnieszka and Greta, it's funny, it was a lovely role because I was able to sit. John Brooke spends a lot of time on set, and, you know, he's part of the story, but he is a quieter, more reserved presence. So I was able to sort of basically spend my time as John and James on set, kind of bearing witness to this master, yeah. Greta and Saoirse and Laura Dern and Meryl Streep. You know, it was amazing. And I what's a shame is that, you know, you never really get to know why Greta is such a masterful director. I mean, she has taken a beautiful, very sort of loved book, which everyone has an opinion or a version on in their head, and done something unique and timeless and relevant. She's inspired a generation of young women in a time when we're all trying to kind of do our piece in a very uncombative way. She's done it in a way which is celebratory. It's the most sort of positive act of feminism I've seen of late, and it was such a privilege to be part of that. But that aside, her work on set as a writer and a director, you know, lots of people assume that, you know, the Greta Gerwig signature, which she managed to protect whilst making something which I think was quite new for her. Everyone sort of assumes that it's all kind of a bit thrown together and a bit mad. You know, there's scenes where we're all kind of having Thanksgiving or Christmas. Absolutely, everything is down to an absolute detail. Those long tracking shots where she's weaving in and out, and, you know, you've got Bob Oldenkirk fucking around and everyone would have to cut because, you know, we'd have to go back to the beginning. Like, she knows exactly what she wants. She comes in, she's so prepared. She works so hard. She was pregnant throughout this film. She created Little Women whilst creating a human being. No, didn't tell anyone. Didn't tell anyone until the ADR, and I heard this, like, gurgling sound on. I don't know what it is. Why she wasn't recognised is a real, real shame.
That thing you say about, my colleague Jack Howard said this thing, and I think it's absolutely right, that she commits the great crime of making something really complicated look effortless.
Yeah.
And therefore, the amount of people who look at Little Women and think, well, it kind of course that's how it would do, you know, that sense of chaos and camaraderie, of course that's completely natural. So I think that's what it is. It's that it doesn't look forced. It looks so fantastically natural that it kind of gets overlooked.
Yeah.
It's not like 1917, in which you're aware of the technical complexity of it.
Yeah. And you know that it's a Greta Gerwig film, but you don't ever feel that she's putting herself front and center. And someone, actually, a journalist offered this to me in an interview recently, and it sort of stayed with me, but he was like, is it that female directors don't want to do that or don't need to do that? Is there, you know, their hubris is ever so slightly different? And, you know, you've got, he compared the scene when Saoirse drops the letter over the river to the scene in the Irishman where the gun falls into the water. And there's something about the long tracking shot landing with the gun and the Scorsese kind of thing. It was very much a sort of moment, a beat, whereas Greta just let it happen. And I don't know what it's his opinion, and I'm not going to hijack it, but something in line with that, which I found interesting, was that, you know, my girlfriend and lots of actresses who I've worked with and talk about this with often complain, and it's always, you know, it's often the thing, understandably so, my God, the role is the girlfriend or the guy, you know, it's the girl in relation to the guy all the time. And I was potentially that, you know, myself and Louis Garrel and Timmy, to a point, were... Timothy, whatever you want, Timothy, is it?
I don't know how you pronounce it. I don't know. I was kind of hoping you would have Timothy. Timothy Chalamet. I don't know. How do you say it? Timmy. That's it. That's solved it. Now find Timmy.
I couldn't do Timothy because I kept thinking shampoo.
I know. <It's just so laughs>
He's the girl with the sun in his hair. That's it. It's just yeah.
But we were the guys. We were the guys who were playing in relation to the girls. Yeah. And she had every right, really. In a way, it's like the kind of whole question, the kind of conversation around objectification. Like, in a way, I wouldn't have minded it had we come on set and I was playing Emma Watson's husband and I was the guy, you know, playing the girlfriend role. And actually, the opposite happened. We turned up for the 2 weeks of rehearsals and she was like, we need to honour your roles and just explore them and investigate them as much as we do the girls. And there was never a hint of, you know, letting the guys just be. Which I think was just, I don't know, it was this incredible testament to her thoroughness and her care and the way she just brought everyone in and included us all. I never felt, it was amazing.
You've also been involved in a very high-profile recent history case that people will be aware of. It was a film before. Let's have a look at the clip.
At the risk of sounding like a broken record, you could do a lot better for yourself than Johnny.
Thanks, Dad.
Chrissy, look at you. Your face is your fortune. Notting Hill is not doing you any favours. At your age, with your connections, my connections.
I'm not Mandy. What was I once? A bit of a laugh and enough spare to keep my mum off my back.
All. Not alls.
All.
Edo's, though. Cash to burn and an eye for a pretty girl. You know the drill. You can have your cake and eat it.
Oh, you never eat it. Just like watching everyone else stuffing themselves.
Crumbs everywhere.
Kinky sod.
It's a terrific piece. I mean, television is now virtually indistinguishable from film in terms of production values and everything, isn't it? I mean, that's just seeing that projected. I could have been showing a clip from a feature film.
I know. I noticed a little bit of TV slip through the net, which is lovely. yeah, I mean, it's you know, recently it's been very clear and it's really, really exciting, the kind of fluid sharing of talent, writers, directors. You know, McMafia was a wonderful experience because James Watkins had only really ever done, Hossein Amini and James were a pair of filmmakers and they came and they made an 8-hour movie basically, and it was great, such exciting thing to be a part of because you get the same sense of support and opportunity, and yet you have the 8 hours to explore, and you know, by the end of those 8 hours you have that character's second nature. Having said that, there is always that kind of understand, you know, rightly, there's a sort of mystique and a sacred thing to that telling of a story in an hour and a half, 2 hour, you know, and I think that will always be the way. And it's an interesting conversation to be had right now, particularly.
We know that the press is full of a lot of tittle tattle, and I don't want to be any part of that. So you officially denied that, yeah.
I wonder where this is going. I can't guess.
Come on, what's the story? What's the story? Because as soon as somebody says, I'm absolutely not being Bond, you go, is he? Because
I don't want to say. I mean, if I say,
Where did it come from?
I've absolutely no idea. I think what happens is when you're on the telly or whatever, we're doing a movie and there's a bit of sort of press around it. The journalists who are, some journalists literally write about this every single day, and they just pick whoever it is, and they create it because it's brilliant clickbait. But I promise you, it is them who's great. They are creating the story, not me. I think they must be in cahoots with the bookies. I have no idea, but it's very lovely, bizarre, fun thing to be part of. And you know, every few days my little sister or my friend calls me, like, is it true? I'm like, no, it's really not true. So I don't know if I say no, it's like yes,
I just love the idea that the Bond producer sat around here, you know, next time I think we need somebody who's more like a Labrador. You know, anyone's like a Labrador.
It's a direction. I mean, yeah. Interesting directions.
We asked you to choose a guilty pleasure,
right?
And God bless you, you did choose a guilty
I did,
pleasure.
I'm guilty.
What is it?
I was immediately worried about it afterwards, but it is properly good. And also, you mentioned also, do you go back to it? I don't go back to this, but yeah. It was something which as a kid I had on VHS and I loved. It is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Thank you.
Okay, tell us about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
What's not good? Like, it's got Brian Blessed in a big robe and Alan Rickman.
Cancelling Christmas. Alan Rickman cancelling Christmas is one of his best ever performances. He does, and cancel Christmas!
With the epic line of, you know, cut your heart out of the spoon. I mean, you know, Kevin Costner gives the weirdest, most bland kind of, I don't know if he's American, English, no one quite knows, even care. And yet around him are this incredible kind of tapestry of performance. Nick Brimble playing Little John, who I got to work with Nick Brimble years later in a TV show, and he walked on set, I fell over, it was starstruck. I actually hadn't seen it for years, and we watched a clip earlier, and it's so fun, it's so cute.
Well, should we have a look? Because it is so fun.
Go on. I challenge you all not to get tingles, because it's...
Loxley! With a spoon!
Then it begins.
What I love most about that is that Rickman turns the word close into a four-syllable word. Close the... And also there's the famous story that, and it's Kevin Reynolds who directed it, isn't it? And that when the first cut was assembled, Costner looked at it and went, no, Alan Rickman is stealing the show. You have to take some of him out. But yeah, because that's what everyone thinks. Everyone thinks it's an Alan Rickman film that happens to have, you know, Kevin Costner and his terrible hair.
Yeah, terrible hair. And Morgan Freeman. I mean, Christian Slater's in this.
Yeah, everyone.
And everyone.
Do you go back to it? Is it a...
I will now. I mean, I haven't for a long time. It's one of those ones where you're sitting in, it's like yesterday with that horrible storm on a Sunday, going, what should we watch? And there's always a little part of me going, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, should we? It's been there for about 15 years and I haven't gone back, but there was a time. My sister had The Sound of Music and I had that on VHS, and it was always a fight to which, yeah.
And The Sound of Music is not a short film. The Sound of Music is 4 hours.
No, I think she won as well, because I remember every single fucking word to every song. So she must have won the battle more than me, I think.
We had somebody wrote into the radio show who'd been to see The Sound of Music twice, and they didn't understand why people liked it because they thought the interval was the end. So they literally watched it twice and it ends with the Nazis, and then that's the end of the film. I think the thing about a guilty pleasure is it's definitely something that gives you joy. And you've watched that clip twice this evening. And both times you've gone like,
doesn't
that.
Doesn't give everyone joy, though? I mean, it's a joyful clip. Yeah, it's true. It definitely takes me back to being a little boy and, wanting to be Robin Hood, I guess.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show. I would urge people to go and see Mr. Jones and obviously Little Women, which I think is still playing in UK cinemas now. What else are we going to see you in next?
I have a
Bob and Bond.
There's a very, very sweet movie I'm very, very proud of. Alberto Pasolini, who was the producer behind Full Monty and others, and Still Life recently with Eddie Mars.
Which is a lovely film. That is a great and underrated film.
But he's a fantastic director, and he only directs once every 10 years when he feels he really has to. He's written this beautiful film. It's currently called Nowhere Special, but I think he's going to change the name, so I can't give you the name, but it's an Uberto Pasolini film, and it's basically about myself and a four-year-old boy and the young father who's dealing with cancer, and he's finding a foster home for his kid before he dies. It's very, very sad, but we had an incredible, incredible time filming it. So that'll be out sometime this year.
Great. We'll come back on the show when it's out. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Really love it. Thank you. Thank you.
So, just time to finish off the show with our usual Sound and Music feature. And I know it's going to come as a great surprise to you all. Here we go.
You didn't have nothing till you met me. Come on, kid, what will it be? Money? Girls.
one particular girl. How about that, Audrey? Think it over. There must be someone you can 86 real quiet like and get me some lunch.
Well, there we are. I hope you enjoyed that. That was the most recent MK3D show, recorded live at the BFI South Bank. The show happens every month. It's been going on for 4 years, and our next show is our 50th anniversary bonanza. If you like the sound of it and you want to come along and see it live, then why not go to the BFI box office and check out the tickets. But do be warned, tickets sell out pretty fast. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, tell your friends, and why not visit our Patreon page, which has a load of extra content, including some exclusive video content. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe and keep watching the skies.
To get chopped up and fed to a hungry plant.
Sure you do.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.